One of the reasons I mentioned this kind of money being used for news media, we know it's used for weapons and for torture and for murdering masses of the population, is that the media really has to be controlled in order to keep people from getting these stories or making these connections. You're allowed to see a single article if you're lucky, but nobody in the United States hardly is even getting anything on the Nugenhan Bank. Maybe two articles, the rest came from Europe. It's really a tragedy to be cut off from the media and the information. There's a conference in New York City for people of alternative media, such as myself. I got some literature before if I wanted to apply for some kind of a grant or a suggestion of what my tapes are like. They're having a conference on small radio stations and small people like myself having programs of interest that maybe could be on a broader scope. But the people in charge of the program, the mail comes out under a big envelope from Larry Josephson. He was the dirty dog at Pacifica Radio who made sure that Bob Fast and I got off the air. I was on there constantly, and they played the radio tapes from 1972 to 75. And we used to do 4- and 5-hour talk shows. And people were really catching on to what's happening in the East Coast. I got to make many friends who are still taking these radio tapes, and I got to meet them at the Elgin Theater. But Bob and I were taken off the air, and Larry Josephson was one of the people at the station that wouldn't let us talk about fascism or Ronald Reagan or Nazis, but they control the alternative media in the same way. And then another person on the board putting on this program is Mankiewicz, Frank Mankiewicz. Well, that's like going to a conspiracy conference and listening to Mark Lane all over again. These men have a tight control over the subject that is very important, disseminating information to people, just as Bill Moyer was on listener-sponsored radio and TV with his show about America. He was press secretary to Lyndon Johnson and kept the lid on all the assassination conspiracy researchers and work and evidence. And then he gets on the stations, the alternative stations, and he's giving out the same kind of BS as Cronkite, only it's the alternative radio, and that's the way the media is controlled. And it really must take big bucks to control the media in such a way. I mentioned Jonestown last week and the money coming from Europe, and Michael Kilduff's book, The Suicide Cult, has a one sentence in there. By 1963, Jim Jones Church was going full speed, and pretty soon he lost a job program that he thought he was secure in having. It was a $350 bill. But he goes on, money was always a mysterious commodity for Jones. Even though he didn't like to take money, it started coming in. And as they mentioned in the book, Kilduff mentions in the book that he had a lot of money. It was always a mysterious commodity. Now, I don't see how writers, and again, this gets to the media, how can people write about Jonestown or write about Gene Harris, who killed Dr. Tannauer, or write about Mark David Chapman, or when Alan Lowenstein was murdered, Dennis Sweeney? How can people write articles and books without knowing who pays for their travels, who put them in these mental hospitals, what was the diagnosis like this Dennis Sweeney, and with the others, how did they make these trips? Who did they see on these trips? This Jean Harris, before she shot Tannauer, there was one article that she was in California just before she shot him. Now, I read this last week, she was in California and also in Colorado. Nobody testifies at her trial, her state of mind, when she went to these two cities. Who did she see? Because she was obviously under mind control. The people that worked with her at the school, at Madera School, before she went up and shot Dr. Tannauer, said she was in a glaze. She didn't communicate. She was starry-eyed. She didn't hear what they said. She was in a catatonic state. All of a sudden, she leaves the room and comes back, and her whole personality has changed, and she's actually probably received a phone call, and she's been told to go do it. And she's in that state of mind, and off she goes. And how come when you write about Jim Jones, you don't say money is a mysterious commodity? When it's that mysterious, it usually is CIA money. And there is no mystery about how Jim Jones got his money, or Mark David Chapman. There has to be a reason or a way, and that's the way I started studying the Kennedy assassination, looking for the money behind Lee Harvey Oswald, because it's the money that matters. It used to be Cherchez la femme, now it's Cherchez la dough. And when you find out where the dough is, then you know who gave the orders for the hit. Another article this last week in the Washington Post, banks are being robbed, embezzled at a record rate. Now, one of the reasons they have to go into these robberies is because so many of them are linked to the intelligence community and to the far right group, and money being taken out with the collusion of people at the bank and being put into weapons to control repressive regimes and bring narcotics back into the states. And this cycle has to end at some point. And the Washington Post brings out the fact that there were 800 cases of embezzlement the FBI investigated last year of more than 100,000. And it refers to the Wells Fargo case again in Los Angeles 2 years ago. 10 million was gone, and now the Wells Fargo, they still go with 21 million. And they talk about the various bank robberies and 45 million from bank robberies in 1980. This is just 45,600,000 in San Francisco, 800 in New York, 1,000 in Los Angeles. Now, those make up practically the total for most of the bank robberies in the country. And many of them, as I read to you on the air several weeks ago, many of those have inside information. The driver, the name of the driver, the route, the names of the children, and so forth. There was a skyjacking attempt, not to get too far off bank robbery. I want to get back on that again. But weird things and weird people are happening. The skyjacking in Los Angeles at the airport last week. The man who got on the plane, Victor Malasukas, had a gun, and the airport will not say how he got through security. They said, we don't want to give out our secrets or discuss it. He worked for the aerospace industry. He was working for a PhD in physics. He was going to the University of Rochester, New York. He didn't have his degree yet. But he had a job as a technical engineer, and he worked at Jet Propulsion Laboratory, an educated man. And when he was arrested, he had no memory or recollection of taking people hostages. He couldn't remember anything except heading towards the airport. He doesn't remember getting on the plane. He doesn't remember the gun. And now they're saying diminished capacity. But what this does is give the appearance that we have a lot of terrorism in this country, and terrorism is the word that is going to give Ronald Reagan or Haig the excuse to take control of the United States. So these attempts at counterintelligence that I said would come much more frequently once that Ronald Reagan was in office are coming so often, I don't even have time to go through half of them and share them with you. Another article, a security guard slain in mystery shooting. Remember, Mark David Chapman was a security guard in an apartment, the one that shot John Lennon. This has to do with the San Francisco Chronicle article. A 22-year-old private security guard was mysteriously shot and killed before his horrified girlfriend in the lobby of a welfare building. The gunman shot four shots with a .38 caliber pistol, again, at close range. And the gunman said it was a total random shooting, and they left. It's just the homicide of security guards is taking place frequently, and also security guards are shooting. And I have a whole list of people, arrests, and murders that are strange that we don't have time to go into each one of them. One L.A. police sergeant charged with vice and aiding and drug dealing, and there's a picture of him, Sergeant Eugene Ingram, and he ran a house of prostitution for Japanese people and Japanese clients. And again, this was in the Hollywood area. He had places in Hollywood and downtown. And the Wells Fargo case involved one bank in Hollywood, and also the Japanese mafia, the implication of using Japanese contacts for much of the operation and the money washing. So this police sergeant is charged with aiding drug dealers, and he's involved with Japanese clientele, the Hollywood division, and he was picked up last week. More charges against the Hollywood policeman came in, the Hollywood division, and so forth. Interesting story about his being picked up. The one million bail sent in weapons drug cachet case. That's the one I mentioned a few minutes ago. It had a lab making Quaaludes and LSD. They did not involve, it did not involve weapons going to South America or a murder. And this person was put on a million bail. And the one who'd been in San Quentin in prison for 15 years on murder charges and violence and weapons of all kinds, and even linked to a missing person right now, is out on $5,000. Another robbery in West Germany. West Germany's huge bank heist, $1.3 million. They now went to the home of the people. I might have mentioned this to you before. I don't remember if I did or not. Just last week, they took $1.37 million and said to the bankers, take us to the bank and get the money out. And they went to the safe deposit and got $820,000 and said, don't be worried, you won't, we won't hurt you. We've done this before. So they just tied up the kids and went off with that money. There's another story in the New York Times that's an interesting one that really gets complicated. Another lot of money, a lot of countries, a lot of contacts. This man is now locked up behind bars, at least he is. He hasn't gotten out yet. Eduardo Rabi, his name is R-A-B-I, you might have seen the article. He uses the name Jack Bender, and allegedly for 28 years he's compiled a dossier on himself. He's living in a New York penthouse. He traveled between South America with Rolls Royces, had home in Monte Carlo and Paraguay and Uruguay, wanted for $60 million worth of swindles. His name and background are a mystery. According to the New York Times, he's been arrested 6 times, convicted twice, never in prison. He made millions of dollars, and he got arrested in Manhattan this last November because of swindling a Mexican woman and also a very bright girl from MIT out of what he said was going to be an investment of her money. So he was picked up, and he said he was a Uruguayan importer, and he uses different names and different passports. He has passports from Lebanon and Canada and Uruguay, and he travels between California, Canada, Switzerland, France, Monaco, Italy, and he's in Panama and, say, Uruguay and Paraguay. His family name, he said, was Rabia, and he was born in Baghdad and Iraq, and then they checked that out, and there were other birthplaces that he gave himself. He said he emigrated to Israel after their independence in 1948. He got his first conviction in 1952 by Interpol, and in Italy in 1957, and was using Lebanese passports. He was arrested in Toronto, where $1.4 million was missing. Now again, bag man carrying money down to Uruguay, and then he mixes up with Mengele's and that genocidal group down in Uruguay. 1.4 million missing when he was arrested in Toronto. He went to prison and pretended that he was paralyzed or had a stroke and then got up and walked out, again in the hands of the police, and walked out. He was in Los Angeles in November 1968, right after Robert Kennedy was assassinated. He used the name Walter R.B., but he had a British passport. And then he left there in a hurry, arrived in August, and then left in a hurry. And his location was an empty place with a desk and a telephone, and then went to Germany, went to Frankfurt, Germany, Paris, London, Monaco, under the name of Jack Bender. And then went to Uruguay and Montevideo and in the early 70s and formed the Pan American Financiera real estate conglomerate with Panama, Paraguay, Uruguay. And again, Panama and Torrijos and the narcotics traffic and the Jones banks and the Nugenhan banks and Nugenhan Australia and the Wells Fargo Australia. There's overlaps of cities. It doesn't prove anything conclusively, but the intent of all these people of working with the same kinds of people and their paths going back and forth and millions of dollars being transferred we should be able sometime to make a pretty good collection of evidence to demand that various charts or maps be presented to members of Congress for some kind of an explanation. He was in the importing and exporting business and had long stories. He had a major Swiss insurance company in which he invested $50 million. And then he claims he lost it. Well, is it like the Nugent hand that he really lost that money and where did it go? Or is it like the Nugent hand that it was intelligence money that was brought in and he was just the bag man with every kind of a passport and every way to get out of arrest and he could continue traveling all over the world? He had $1.5 million from Balfour Williamson, which was a Swiss finance company. Then he went down to Paraguay in 1978, and he was arrested by the Paraguayan police and had a nervous collapse and an out-of-court settlement. Then went to New York and said that he paid Paraguay $2.5 million in cash in order to get out of there, and that he left $13 million to get out of Paraguay. Now, he may say they were chasing me out of there, so I had to leave it there. Was he a bag man who was delivering this money, like from the Bahamas down to Paraguay and from the Swiss banks to Paraguay, or the Nugent hand to Perry? Was he working in with Nassau, Bahama, and this Castle Bank, where they had money flowing out? They had millions into the billions into these banks in the Cayman Islands, in Panama, by the CIA, that then flows out. Well, why wouldn't it flow into this man's hands? He's never been arrested. He goes country to country. The only reason he's been picked up now is that he messed around with a young gal and tried to sell her something that was fraudulent and on a minor thing, and she pressed charges, and he's probably done it 100 times, and nobody pressed charges. But he says he left, lost $50 million in one Swiss insurance company, and then he had to leave $13 million when he left Paraguay, and he was in New York in 1980 with this fancy apartment with a Miss Del Mazo, MIT student, a graduate student from Mexico. He sold her $100,000 of worthless shares in a meat company in Denver, Colorado, and it, of course, as I say, Jean Harris overlaps her trip to Los Angeles and to Denver. We can't prove anything, I keep repeating, but these people have traveled to China, to the Middle East, to London, to Germany, and the important thing about it isn't just that they hit those cities, it's that you have to read 300 papers a week to just find that they were in fact there. In other words, what would make very interesting stories isn't being told. I simplify it for you because 1 hour a week, I tell you where these people were, but I have to sit sometimes 12 hours a day, 3 or 4 days, going through literally hundreds of newspapers each week to pick up these little pieces. This story was in the New York Times, but then the story about Jean Harris, maybe the Denver thing, was all the things of her trial was in one Washington Post or one New York News, just one piece here and one piece there, and you find that they were crisscrossing the same kind of routes. So he had sold her something in Denver, Colorado, and she arrested him, and he's supposed to be in jail now. The last article that came out, the Associated Press this week, is Swindler Behind Bars, and has to do with the matter of the selling her as part of a chicken ranch or a fraudulent investment that didn't hold. But I'm sure, with his contacts, that he will be out very soon. Now, the long article in the New York Times, and it was a long article on this man, and it was also reprinted in our San Jose Mercury, leaves out something which the Globe put in. And they're interested in Magalies. The Globe is like the Star and the National Enquirer. And what the great New York Times leaves out was that this man was down in Uruguay. He left Monaco and Switzerland and went to Paraguay, and then he made associations down in Paraguay with General Andre Rodriguez, the number two man of the Paraguayan dictatorship, and he says he's the one who saved him from prison, I guess, for getting all those millions of dollars. But when his immunity ended, when Robbie began to suspect that a top banker in the country was actually the notorious Nazi angel of death, Dr. Mengele's, he asked General Rodriguez if Mengele's had an interest in my bank, where I was depositing $600,000, Rob asks. And he said yes. And then Rob says, I stopped using the bank, but later the general wanted me to sign over $14 million in land to make up for his losses. and they told me I wouldn't get out unless I did it, so I paid 14 million ransom to escape to Uruguay. So that this Mr. Rab is in the contact with Mengele's in South America, who is a direct partner who has access to $14 million of this international con man. And I think that the scandal of not bringing his relationship and his banking to the front has to do, again, with what they would call national security, the Castle Bank, the Grand Caymans, and that missing money. They don't want to come up with where it is because it would link the CIA, and you wouldn't want the CIA to know, tell you that they were funding Mengele's for experiments on Indians and natives and possibly the people at Jonestown through, again, colonial dignitas contacts that he's very much a part of. This has been hushed by the media because it is a big story. The millions and millions and millions of money going to the far right, keeping the people down, suppressing them, starving off the natives into real genocide and calling them banking failures. I don't think they're banking failures, and the story of this one man down there with Mengele tells a lot. It also tells you about the New York Times leaving something out that the Globe was willing to print. I'm in touch with the Globe, and I sent them my document on Mengele's being an American citizen, and there's a good possibility that they're going to print that now. They've done two stories on Mengele's. Finally, I'll do one big missing story. It was in the San Francisco Chronicle by Warren Hinkle, Hinkle's Journal, a financial scandal that rattles the Pacific. Now, this is the story that I briefly mentioned to you before about a fellow from the Philippines named Dewey D. And this isn't on the Associated Press, United Press, and if you see it in other newspapers, send me the clipping. Dewey D. is a rich young man out of Manila who lived in the Philippines. He's the mysterious Mr. D. He's sort of a one-man Chrysler Corporation who went over the wall with the government lunch money. He's a capitalist Robin Hood who takes from the rich and gives to the richer. He's one of the biggest crooks in the Philippines. He's a friend of the dictator, President, and Mrs. Ferdinand Marcos. And when he disappeared, they believed that it was a clandestine flight with capital from the Philippines, and no one knows where it ended. Now, he left the Philippines. This article came out February the 3rd, just last month, 1981. He left there with this large amount of money, $70 million or more, out of the Philippines, to deposit probably for the Marcos in another country. And the point is that he has emptied the country out of money, and the Philippines owes the World Bank so that the United States citizens will have to take out their tax money to make up for the difference going to the Philippines, because we have to still, in quote, support them. They are a bulwark against communism in Asia. You've heard that one before. This story says that this rascal Dewey D. is reputed to be so rich he has dollar signs on his socks, and he's linked, of course, again, to organized crime. He's like the Asian Rockefeller. He may even be the Asian Vesco. Warren Hinkle used to work with Ramparts Magazine and does freelance writing. D was stripped of his epaulets as director and owner of the Security Bank of Manila. He cashed out the bank owing $2.5 million and skipped away with that and resigned, and then he left two Filipino partners with $18 million purchased in Redwood City National Bank in California, and he took that $18 million. He took $50 million of other bankers' money from the Philippines and went out of the Bank of Manila and took this money with him. And they believe that he is investing it in other matters and probably salting it away, such as the Prones did, in case the Philippine government were ever to fall down. This article says, the mystery is the story of how Dewey D. got out from under with his bank control in the Philippines, how one man could manage to borrow so much money in so short a time and get out of the country with it. You know, Wells Fargo, they were saying that Harold Smith got a hold of $21 million in a short time by just going to Australia. There's no way that amount of money could leave the country, according to Warren Hinkle, without someone high up in the government knowing about it. He has friends everywhere and investments all over the world. And he has taken large amount of money. And the article says that the flight of capital from the Philippines, it may suggest that the Marcos will fall, such as the Shah in Iran and Somoza and Nicaragua. And we have to have a new set of money. What if the generals and the Catholic Church and so forth come in? We have right now a set of oligarchs and the Marcos and the president. But what if that falls? So he's taken money from a bank in California that he had, and other money from the Philippines. 50 to 70 to $100 million is gone. And as I say, the article says that eventually, when he takes that, ultimately the American government, which is propping up the Marco regime through the World Bank loans, is the major guarantor, and the people of the United States will have to make up the difference. One of the subscribers to my tapes, listens every week, sent me a second part of an article, part two, "The Money Makes the Mob Go Round, The Invisible Enterprise," from Forbes. This is October 13th, 1980, just before the end of the year. And it talks about the organized crime and the loot that they have and how they invest it into the United States. They give the example of the Westchester Theater in New York and the washing of money by the mob into businesses in the United States. It's a good article, and you can get it at the library. Forbes, October 13th, 1980, by James Cook, on organized crime coming into the money market. Now, if organized crime takes their money laundering and builds restaurants or dry cleaning places or puts it into business, it is visible in some other form. They can buy up franchises and control all of the mozzarella cheese and the pizza parlors and maybe the taco places or whatever, and they're putting it back into a business. But what I'm talking about in terms of the possible Wells Fargo money, that whether it was $200 or $300 million, or the Nguyen Han money, or the banks in the Cayman banks in the Bahamas, the Panama money, the Jonestown money, the Nguyen Han franchises were definitely CIA assassination, killing money. And when you pay $1 million to one person for killing off the President of the United States, memos in the Howard Hughes collection sent $1 million to Richard Nixon at Key Biscayne, give $1 million to Lyndon Johnson in Texas. That wasn't just because they weren't going to run again, or because they were good boys, or they were particularly loyal to the Howard Hughes empire. The Hughes empire was another CIA funnel of money, and it went to the assassination teams. Johnson was president because Kennedy was murdered, and Nixon was president because Robert Kennedy was murdered. And never forget that. This was killing money, and then there's a lot of people to pay off, and the people that keep quiet and the entourage around them, and then fanning out the levels that rub next to them, maybe innocent or dumb or suspicious. There is talk in Washington and coming out in various books about almost common knowledge of the conspiracies and how they came down, but nobody yet is willing to take a giant step and scream we've had enough. But when the banks begin to get siphoned out of all this money, and it's missing money, and you've invested along with them, then your investment is shaky. And when the FBI has to begin investigating banks that are cracking up to the tune of so much money, and if it's just going to assassination teams, then something has to give. And eventually they're going to have to finger how Jonestown came down, who funded Mark David Chapman or Gene Harris or many, many other people, how they get to Europe and Asia and their living quarters and transportation and so forth. And the problem of mixing all the intelligence, killing money with ordinary money of investors, is that the investors will get burned out until the government and the FBI call a halt, which isn't likely with Ronald Reagan in office because the whole entourage around him are so closely tied to the assassination teams. In the meantime, this is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. You take care, and I'll be back with you next week.